Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So, thank you for being here. Appreciate you showing up. It's been a crazy couple weeks. I ended up getting sick again. I know probably everybody here who's been following this for any amount of time is probably sick of me saying I'm sick, but it's been weird. You know, like all last year, I feel like a good run of health, and then the last 6 weeks, four out of the last 6 weeks, I've been pretty sick. And this second virus that I got, or bacterium, was much more respiratory, whereas the other one was all up in my nose. And so it's kind of like having two different styles of feeling unwell. And so that was fun. And I've just been tired. And I started a new job. Right now I'm doing cleaning. So I'm doing like janitorial work at nights. And like I'm cleaning this hospital factory that builds carts, like all those weird carts you see like the nurse ladies have that have like all the technological stuff on them. So they got like sheet metal that they cut and then they fabricate it. And then they have like powder coating, which is like this type of paint. And it's all these huge conveyor systems. And I've never seen anything like this in my entire life. So it was kind of cool to be in the environment. And I'm just kind of like a night person going around shucking trash bags, you know, and cleaning bathrooms. It's not really hard, but it's a little bit extra money. And so learning how to adapt to all these new life changes and these new requirements for my being has been different. If you have ever gotten used to anything, like if you formed a habit in anything, and that's all life is this habit forming construction where we find easy ways to do things and then we tie enough easy way to do things together to fill up our time with a little bit of doing nothing too. You know, we always need some rest. But we end up in this like cyclical thing where we're running the treadmill and finding ourselves in the same place every Monday at 2 o'clock. You know, I know exactly where I'm gonna be at Monday at 2 o'clock, you know? And when we shift in new ideas and new hobbies and new work and all these things that we could add in, and of course on the inverse of that is also taking away whenever we lose something, this incurs a change. And that can be stressful. The day before I started my new job, I was thinking about it a lot. And it's like, we're not even there yet, but we're forecasting. And when we're nervous or ambivalent about something, and ambivalence is kind of like this emotional reaction to a tug of war that is happening inside of us. And there's always like this duality of forces towards something or away from something. You know, at least for me, I'm perpetually arguing inside my head about what the fuck I'm supposed to do, you know? And when there's a contest between two desires in our head, especially when the contest has not been weighted and nobody seems to be victorious yet, nobody seems to have an edge, you know, this contest produces a friction, just like somebody who's trying to start a fire. You have a lot of intentional abrasive pressure that goes into using the wood against the rock or the wood or whatever, you know, but it requires a bit of violence in order to create that heat, right? And so ambivalence to me is like this mental heat that comes from mental abrasion, from different parts of our mental faculties rubbing against each other. It's like there's this complex ecosystem of feelings and aspects and intuitions. And then there's darkness and stuff that doesn't talk. There's shy parts. And then there's very vocal parts and there's very controlling parts who run the show for such a long period of time. And so throughout our days, there's this perpetual cycle of stuff that goes through, and we add on to it and we take it away. And during times of change, there's a bit more ambivalence. And this happens with people, you know, when we're ever desiring somebody, if we're looking to try to become a partner of somebody, you know, there's this possessiveness, especially in Western culture, over even what that is, right? And so when I have found myself looking outwards at people, at attributes that I like, you know, there's been this contest in my head back and forth between how and what I even want to think about people. And I know that's because I tend to be leaning very heavily on the introspective actions of this mental life. And a lot of other people, it seems, don't spend as much time as concerned and worried about what they do as I do. But I'm always intensely studying how these interactions reverberate, because there's a wave-like shape to how things become. And when I say a wave, consider how waves hit a shore. They come up and they curl and they form that beautiful, beautiful curve that I've always found so fascinating. And every wave and every different beach has a different slight shape, you know? But it comes up and it rushes up onto shore. The shore in this place being surface awareness, and the wave in this case being all those feelings and all those ideas about what's going on, all these judgments and all these discriminations and distinctions about your world. And they wash over your waking self right here in this little locality that we sit in the captain's chair. And then we have to learn how to deal with that. And that's one of the biggest components to being a human being. So just consider maybe finding value in discovering yourself, investigating your patterns, investigating your weather, investigating all the different pieces and the different ways that your pieces show themselves. I found it very valuable for me. And I feel ignorant because I barely discovered less than 5% of my inner psyche. It's like the ocean. Like when you consider how huge and massive the ocean is, they say that we've barely scratched the surface of all the things. There could be megalodons down all the way in the bottom of those deep, deep trenches. There's all these spaces and worlds, like whole universes that exist inside of you. You know, in a lot of ways, it's almost like we're a mirror for the universe, really. And if we're just a reflection of it, that begs the question of how much material concern, at least the heaviness, you know, all the heavy guilt and all the heavy discriminations, the heavy judgments we make about ourselves. You know, when we think about how we're just reflections of the universe, that takes some of the solitary need to own all of it away. Because every single human being is struggling with similar darkness and similar shadow structures. We all have similar methods of torturing ourselves and other people. And nobody's just good, and nobody's just bad. Nobody's only noble, and nobody's only gross and lowly. We all have these tediums and these brilliances that glimmer and murky the work of everybody else around us. And when I begin to go into these esoteric, you know, more word salad, more constructs, because these are just more verbal ideas to describe this thing that exists outside of the rational reasoning reasoner that perceives what's being reflected on this mirror, that sees this reflection. It's like there's this eye seeing the mirror, you know, and part of that could be the ego, and we could call it the witness. But any piece that has fractured off of the whole to look at it is separated and isolated. Can you hear what I'm getting at? If we're still looking at it and considering it, then we're not outside of reason. And that's been this mindfuck for me. It's because I'll get so abstract in my head and I'll forget that I'm still thinking. And I'll come up with ideas and I'll come up with metaphors like my waves. And I'll think up of all these wordy animals, these wordy creatures that I try to breathe life into as a metaphor to hope to describe this thing. But the action of doing that is itself like an oxymoron. It's like Fight Club, you know? The one rule about Fight Club is you can't talk about it. And what I'm trying to talk about, one word for it, which is just another word, in Buddhism is called non-duality. Now, duality is every single speck of the material world. It's not just two things, it's separation. When you have objects that fill a space, like in front of me, I have a mirror, I have my closet door, and I have my bookshelves, and my mind has discriminated all these objects as separate pieces, right? But for maybe for a Buddhist, they might say that all these objects exist as a whole, as part of the universe. And it's only my mind that carves out a space and gives it a name to consider it as a mirror. Does that make any sense at all? Sometimes it doesn't make any sense to me, because it's hard to make sense of it when you're sitting in the captain's chair. There's this one Hindu practice that was given by some yogi that I can't remember the name of, and it's called Neti Neti, where you're supposed to sit in meditation and you start out with the framework of I am, and then you add stuff to it. You know, I am me. Well, me is not, me is a distinction, me is an object, so I'm not that. I am Brandon. That's just my name, you know? So I'm not just a naming that somebody gave me. I am a cook. That's just my vocation. That's just a job. That's not who I am. I am happy. I am sad. I am lost. I'm frustrated. I am confused. How about this one? I am alone. Now, if the mirror is just something that I've carved out of reality, wouldn't my sense of aloneness also be another sense that I've carved out of reality, out of a wholeness, and I've took a piece of it and I've tried to tie a bow around it and say I own it and I own this feeling, I own this piece of possession of, this is what's happening to me. And all of a sudden that can be pitiable. Now I can hold a grudge if anybody steps against me. So what I'm trying to describe here is some of the ramifications that comes from these systems that we use to get through the world and to get what we need to survive. And we have to survive, trust me. But could it be that they're all illusions and fabrications of our minds? This doesn't discredit the reality of the universe or the world. It doesn't discredit your existence or your birth. It just seeks to examine all the extra shit that we add on to it. And I was reading the sutra, which sutras are old Buddhist monastic texts that are basically students talking to students, and the Buddha is often a character. I doubt whether it's actually the words of Buddha, but sometimes it's close. It's a close maybe. It's similar feelings that I have to Jesus in the Bible. You know, since Jesus didn't write anything down about what he thought, you have to trust these opinions of people who you have faith were close to this person, right? And the one I was reading, I think it was the Vimalakirti, something like that. Vimalakirti? I pronounced it bad, I'm sorry. But in it, you have all these bodhisattvas, which bodhisattvas are enlightened individuals who have transcended their humanness to a degree. But they, even though they may have the power to go on different planes of existence, and for the Buddhas, they thought that the gods had their own worlds and their own planes, and you could commune with gods or deities, or at least different creatures that existed at a different vibratory pattern, whatever hoodoo way you want to try to conceive this, it's all just words. But they choose to stay on this plane of existence with humanity so as to help all the people who haven't woken up yet to wake up and to have realization of who they are. So that's kind of the definition of what a bodhisattva is. So in the story, the Buddha is sitting with a bunch of bodhisattvas, and they're all having conversations about non-duality. And it starts off by calling this idea of non-duality the door of non-duality. Because even in that idea is this insertion that on one side of the door is one place, and on this side of the door there's another place. So if you go into a place where there is no separation from both of those distinctions, how can there ever be a door? How would you open a door like that? It's a complete mind puzzle right at the beginning. And then all the bodhisattvas take turns describing different systems of distinction, and they kind of break it down into this formula, which kind of goes like one of the ones I wrote about in my journal that I used because I was trying to practice the formula was, because I wasn't feeling very well, I was feeling kind of sick last weekend, and I wrote something like, to feel unwell is not to take anything away from who I am, and to feel well is not to give anything to who I am. Within both wellness and unwellness, there's an empty distinction that has no degree on who I am. And you can do that with anything, you know? To feel happy or to feel not happy. To feel happy does not give me anything as a boon to increase who I am or whatever. And to not be happy doesn't take away anything either. And there's a lot of different ways they went around it, but it's basically just looking at both sides of having something and not having it, which is what most things are, is desiring to have them or being averted from not wanting it to happen to you, or to want something, an object, or to not want something that is painful, like a lack of health. It's murky when we start talking about this kind of stuff, but I felt drawn to it. So we started with considering the use of introspection. The next, we discussed some principles of non-duality, and I'll share a couple of texts after I get done talking. And then last, I'd want to discuss just a little bit this principle of a philosophy called cynicism, which is one of my favorites. Cynicism comes from a man named Diogenes, who predated Socrates, most likely, in Athens and throughout a lot of regions of Greece and all their different city-states and individually governed communistic kind of places. And Diogenes would sleep in a barrel, and he had nothing. All he had was a blanket. And his system of thought was basically, the only things that you needed were what nature gave you. And so that does not include any creature comforts or pleasures that mankind has created, such as in the modern world, we have TV and convenient foods and hot water baths and heat and air controlled homes and cars with environmentally controlled zones so that we can drive to places in the winter completely comfortably. You know, like, we have created all these things to help soothe us and to make our lives easier, which on one side is not a problem. I think that's fine. I think it's amazing that we've done this. But Diogenes did not feel that way, because in his philosophy, the only thing you needed was your self-reliance and so things that you could do. And all you had was gifted by nature. And so he would give up everything that he owned. He never worked. He would beg for food. He would beg for like homes. If he needed to be inside, he would beg to sleep inside somebody's house. Or he'd sleep in a barrel with the dogs. And the dogs, these stray dogs, the Greek word for it was like sinceros or something like that. Sinero, or sin something. And so using that sin prefix is where you get cynicism, cynic. And in a lot of ways, I live a somewhat cynic lifestyle. Like, there's a lot of things I'm missing. Like, a lot of people will come into my house and they'll be like, why don't you have this or that or this? And I don't own a lot of things. The most shit that I own are my books. And like, one day I'll have to downsize those and only keep the important ones too. But this theme of minimalism that's starting to be perpetuated in this new world that we're moving into, with more people living full-time out of their cars, making van life, this travel culture where people aren't living traditional standard lives where they work a 9-to-5 just to own an apartment like I do. You know, it makes me consider all the different ways of human being, and I think that we are moving into a much more cynic lifestyle. I think cynicism is on the rise, and I don't think a lot of people are even going to know what that is or you're going to see it happening, because cynicism is not pessimism, it's not negativity. And minimalism isn't nothing. Minimalism isn't poverty. One of the things Diogenes said was to treat pleasures like a tyrant. Like, get away from me, dictator. How dare you? That's how he treated his extreme highs. And he'd only eat lentil soup because it was boring and bland, which would help him maintain his own frame of mind through not being blown around like a napkin on the wind by the whims of our desires and aversions. All right. Well, I'm going to go find a book, share a couple quotations, and we'll go get Odin to sign you off. I really appreciate you sitting here and listening. I still haven't fixed my equipment, so those crackles and pops and weird sparkle thingies that I can't seem to edit out are probably interlaced through this. And so if you've made it through the end just to hear what my opinions were, I really appreciate it. I'm here for you. I want to be of service to this world and to our species and to you. I want to be a friend, and I want to be somebody you can lean on. If you'd like to have a conversation at any time, you can email me at thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. That's a really long URL, so you can find that in the show notes. And I'll talk to you about anything, even if you want to criticize my thoughts. I'll take it. Like, let's do it. All right, I'll be right back. All right, this is from the section in the Vimalakirti Sutra that I was discussing just a couple minutes ago. Here goes. Tisya Bodhisattva said, "Good and bad are a duality. When we don't conceive of good or bad, we enter the formless realm and thereby understand this is the door of non-duality." Simha Bodhisattva said, "Retribution and blessing are a duality. When we use the diamond wisdom that cuts through such characteristics, and we understand that the nature of a retribution is no different from that of a blessing, there is neither bondage nor liberation. This is the door of non-duality." Simhamati Bodhisattva said, "Purity and impurity are a duality. When we realize all dharmas are equal, and we don't create conceptions of purity or impurity, and we don't become attached to their characteristics or dwell on the absence of their characteristics, this is the door of non-duality." Sudamakukti Bodhisattva said, "The conditioned and the unconditioned are a duality." This is a big one to me. "When we use untainted wisdom and are no longer obstructed and are free from category and our mind is like space, this is the door of non-duality." Narayana Bodhisattva said, "The world and beyond the world are a duality. Since the nature of the world is empty, it is beyond the world. As long as one doesn't enter or leave, glorify or reject either one, this is the door of non-duality." Dantamati Bodhisattva said, "Samsara, which is ignorance, and nirvana, which is enlightenment, are a duality. When one sees the nature of samsara, there is no samsara, there is no bondage or liberation, no fire or annihilation. Such is an understanding, is the door of non-duality." Pratyaka Sardansana Bodhisattva said, "The end and no end are a duality. Whether something ends completely or doesn't end, both are conceptions without end. Conceptions without end are empty. And being empty, there is no conception of an end or no end. Penetrating this is the door of non-duality." Pariguda Bodhisattva said, "Self and no self are a duality. Since the self can't be found, how are you going to find no self? Seeing the true nature of the self and no longer thinking about an other, this is the door of non-duality." And it goes on like that for several more pages. But it's this formula of just taking both distinctions and then finding the space outside of that. And it's not that. You can't just say no, you know? God, this whole concept has just been fascinating me for the last couple weeks. So I really appreciate you letting me share that with you. Thank you for listening. I'm going to go get O.
Hey, guys. It's Ask O and the Gingerbread Man.
Woo!
I'm finally back.
Cool. Has it been snowing a lot?
Yes.
Have you been having a lot of snow days?
Yes.
Is that an airplane?
Yes. We actually live in Colorado, and it's 2024 now.
No way.
And
only here, though. Only in Colorado. Nowhere else.
Yeah. And there's a lot of snow at our apartment complex.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
Okay. You have any advice?
Nah.
Okay. Have a good week. Bye.